Hey, everybody, welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. Hi, my name is Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRIS. I'm also your host. You know that already if you're listening. Happy New Year, everybody. Hope you had a great holiday. Hope everybody has a great 2026 ahead of us. And that's what we're going to do in the month of January in our podcast. We have a special two-parter for January with the podcast. We're going to talk in this episode about the three biggest trends or kind of most important cases or issues that we dealt with in 2025 in the world of public safety labor relations. And who decides what the three most important issues are? I do. It's my podcast. So we're going to talk about that. And then next week or next episode, whenever we post the second part of this episode, we're going to talk about three trends that we see on the horizon in 2026. So a little bit of 2025, a little bit of 2026, and then next month we'll resume with all kinds of new cases. So that's the game plan. Stick around. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome to First Thursday. First things first, as always, what's happening at LRIS seminars is what's happening. We're kicking off our 2026 roster of seminars. At the end of this month, we have our union leadership seminar, which is always a blast. It's going to be at the Sonesta Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. We're in Nashville three times in 2026. Everybody wants to go to Nashville. It is a lot of fun. And Sonesta is a pretty great place. So I guess that's why people want to go. But that's a really great seminar, January 28th through the 30th. Really just for folks on the union side of things, from police, fire, and corrections. We're going to have labor leaders from all over the country kind of talking about the issues that they deal with in the day-to-day and also the kind of the special events of running their unions. This year, the special emphasis is going to be on communications, politics, things like that. We got a big election year in 2026. So we're going to hear, I think, from like the best in the business about how they do that on behalf of their locals. And we're also going to talk about issues related to member wellness and particularly PTS and where are we, you know, in collective bargaining land with regard to addressing PTS issues. So that should be a great seminar. And then we're back in Vegas, of course, in June for our Rights of Police Officers seminar. That's June 18th through the 20th at the Horseshoe and the Parish, right there in the heart of Vegas, the heart of the Strip in June. If you want information about any of those things, just check us out at www.lrs.com/seminars. Also, by the way, if you do this kind of thing on social media, you can check us out on TikTok. I think it's like RickP67 is our LRIS TikTok. Maybe it's not, but I bet you can find us. Anyhow, that's what's going on with LRIS. And let's now move into what happened in 2025. Okay, big developments in 2025. You know, when I look back at the year, you know, obviously we talk about cases mostly on the podcast, but we also talk about just, you know, other developments, legislative developments or issues in the news, the kind of things that we talk about, you know, at the seminars. You know, we don't just do cases, we do lots of other things. We have a recent developments presentation at every seminar, and that's what makes it recent is we talk about what's happening. So we don't usually look backwards. We usually kind of, you know, just talk about what's happening right now. But if I look back on 2025, you know, what I think was the most important or significant issue with respect to legal developments related to public safety was in the area of privacy, primarily in the area of speech, but not just speech, like speech and social media issues, but, you know, beyond that into other issues. And, you know, we saw, I think we always see the privacy issue, you know, come up in public safety labor relations because people care about the work that police officers, firefighters, correctional officers do. It's important work, so people have opinions about it. The news media is interested in it. If a police officer does something, you know, it's probably going to make it into the newspaper or, you know, into some form of media because people will click on it, people will read it. And so there is, a, you know, more attention paid to these types of issues, and it, you know, it puts people's personal privacy at risk, or, you know, maybe the safety of themselves or their families. And so something, you know, that we, I know that our folks who subscribe and who attend seminars care about, and it's something that, you know, that I absolutely care about. The big issue with respect to privacy in 2025 was social media and speech protections and privacy protections. And there were, you know, interestingly, there were a bunch of cases that were decided at the circuit court level right in the fall that were all social media cases, all of them involving police officers, or actually it was police officer, firefighter, teacher, public sector employees, who all took positions on social media about what was happening in 2020, right? And so, you know, because the wheels of justice turn slowly, as we like to say, they do, right? So a lot of cases, you know, we've had employers discipline employees. There's a lawsuit that flows from it. These are federal court decisions that we're talking about. It takes a while for those cases to kind of make their way through the legal process. And so it wasn't until, you know, we're talking about events that happened in the country in May and in June of 2025, or I'm sorry, May and June of 2020 was when, you know, people were commenting on things for the most part. There's one comment from 2021, but it took until 2025 to get, you know, circuit court, appellate court decisions. And the way that the federal judicial system is set up is that the first level are what we call district courts, and they're spread everywhere throughout the country. And then the country is divided into different districts, different appellate court districts. And so I'm sitting here in the third circuit for federal courts in the United States, because I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And so cases make their way up to the circuit courts. And, you know, if there's a split in the circuit courts, you know, a case might make its way all the way up to the big old U.S. Supreme Court. And so it takes away a while for cases to get themselves up there. And we had three speech decisions that made their way to the circuit courts that I think reflect maybe the direction that the courts may be going right now with respect to privacy and speech. That was interesting enough. And there were three cases decided in a week in different parts of the country. So three different circuit courts within, I think it was like 10 days, maybe. We had these three decisions issued with all different looks, you know, or I guess views on the public employee speech, you know, issue as presented on the facts in their particular cases. What made this stuff really interesting was that, you know, right in the wake of the decisions being decided, we had the Charlie Kirk shooting. And, you know, not the shooting itself, right? I mean, unfortunately, that happens. Those things happen. Assassination attempts happen. Successful assassinations happen in this country and in other countries. You know, so nothing particularly interesting about that, honestly. What was interesting about it was the response. And the overwhelming response by people on social media to get people fired on the basis of things they said about Charlie Kirk. Now, that's always kind of happened. But the breadth and depth of the response, you know, doxing, identifying people, you know, specifically urging employers or threatening employers to fire people who made these types of comments, it was something that we'd never seen. We'd never seen that in our country. And, you know, that's what makes it interesting. And I'm not sure what, you know, what we're going to see next. And, you know, it took us 5 years to get to the George Floyd cases that I'm going to talk about. And I don't know how many more years it's going to take us to get to the Charlie Kirk cases, because, you know, we've got hundreds and hundreds of employees, depending on which source you look at, who were disciplined in some way, shape, or form. Many, many fired for making comments on social media, basically saying, I didn't like Charlie Kirk, you know, and, you know, whatever version of that they said. And, I'm not so disappointed that this thing happened. You know, people say a lot of stupid and inappropriate and offensive and rotten things on social media. The question is, you know, do they have a right to say it if they're a public employee? And what is the government's ability as their employer to impose discipline against somebody based on comments they make on social media? And whether they're doing that in response to a coordinated effort, you know, designed to get people fired, or whether it's just somebody came across the post without even a complaint, how should employers respond to this? And so You know, when we try to look at things in the new world of, you know, really active partisan campaigns to get people fired, what should we be aware of? And so the main thing that we need to be aware of, or I would suggest that we be aware of, is what the rules are. And, you know, while the times have changed and the technology has changed, the rules really aren't that different. When a court looks at, or when a public employee, a public safety employee, so a police officer, is disciplined on the basis of something that they said or something that they posted on social media, do they have a right to allege that the government, their employer, violated their constitutional rights, their First Amendment right to speak? Yeah, they do. And there's a framework that courts use to analyze these cases. And if you are really, really interested in this stuff, I think I would go back and listen to, I think it was our October episode, where we did actually did a live webinar. Jessica Caggiano, one of my colleagues, and myself talked about a bunch of cases, including the three I'm going to quickly summarize in greater detail. And that was a really popular episode, probably our most popular of the year because of the interest in the issue. And the court, the Supreme Court, laid out this framework for kind of striking the balance between the government's you know, obligation, certainly their right, but probably their obligation to run an efficient workplace, versus an employee's right to exercise, you know, their ability to speak, you know. And the test goes all the way back to a case, a U.S. Supreme Court case from the late 60s called Pickering versus Board of Education. And that involved a teacher who wrote a letter to the editor criticizing the school board's spending, you know, and basically said you should be spending more money on books and teachers and not on, I think in that particular case, they were, they had, I think, were floating a bond to increase taxes so that they could build like a better gym, a better sports facility. And so there was some dispute about that. Pickering writes a letter to the editor. He criticizes the school board. He criticizes their priorities, and they fire him, you know, for having the temerity to criticize his bosses, God forbid. And he ultimately won. Case makes its way up to the Supreme Court. He wins, and the Supreme Court gives us this test. We call it the Pickering test. And there are really three questions. Sometimes it's two, sometimes it's three, but I like to say it is three. One is, we look at, did the employee speak as a private citizen or did they speak as a public employee? Right? If you're speaking as a private citizen, you're going to be protected. If you're speaking, you know, as a police officer, if it's part of your job, if you're the public information officer at a particular department, and that's part of your job to express opinions on things, then you're not going to have, you might have some protections, but you're not going to have nearly the same degree of protection that you would have if you're speaking as a private citizen. And in fact, that's the first prong of the test. If a court determines that you're not speaking as a private citizen, too bad, so sad, you're out of luck. So the first question is, are you speaking as a private citizen or as a public employee? Second question, right? Court determines that you're speaking as a private citizen. Okay, we get to go to question number two. Is the speech a matter of public concern? What are you talking about? Is it something the public, you know, should give a crap about? Or is it just some private, you know, workplace gripe that, you know, isn't really a matter of public concern? And there's lots of cases on that. There's, you know, 60 years of cases on this stuff that I'm not going to go through. But if a court determines that, yeah, you're speaking as a private citizen, and yeah, you're speaking on a matter of public concern, and let's apply it to the Charlie Kirk framework. You know, you're a police officer working somewhere, a firefighter working somewhere. You have an opinion on the Charlie Kirk assassination. You're expressing your personal opinion, not the opinion of the fire department. So you're speaking as a private citizen. And clearly the assassination of a public figure is a matter of public concern. You've passed those two prongs of the test. And so now we get to the third prong, and that's where the balancing comes into effect. And the balancing test is, hey, is the employee's First Amendment right, is their right to speak out on matters of public concern, outweighed by the government's interest in running an efficient operations, right? So is the, can the employee's speech damage the government or injure the government, you know, in its role of, you know, providing effective and efficient public services? Your rights versus theirs. That's what this is all about, man. It's balancing rights. And so that's the Pickering test. Private citizen, public concern, whose rights are more important? And in each of these cases that come down the pike, and we see them all the time, that's really what the court's doing. The court's just balancing interests. And do judges or at circuit court levels, panels of judges. These are several judges, either three judge panels, or sometimes we'll go to the full court on occasion. All these judges bring to their work their own positions, you know, on how the law should be applied and how the law should be interpreted. And so we have conservative judges, we have liberal judges, we have pragmatic judges, you have any kind of judge that you might imagine, and they're all going to bring like their bag of experiences to a particular case. And that's where we see differences, you know, in the balancing, because some judges might lean, you know, heavily in favor of private, an individual's interest to express themselves, and others might be more institutionalist and say, no, the government has a pretty important job here, you know, to provide pretty important services, and its interests are generally going to be more important, right? And they might carry those I would call them biases, nothing inappropriate about those biases. They carry those biases with them, you know, into their decision-making process. And, you know, it was interesting to see these three cases that were decided in August of 2025 that were speech cases that showed different ways that judges applied the balancing test and what they think, you know, what judges in those cases might think are important factors. And that's why they're useful for us to consider when we're dealing with the issue in your department. If somebody posted something stupid, you know, on Twitter, on X, and now the department's angry, are they going to have a basis for discipline or not? Like, how do we deal with that from the union's perspective or from the management's perspective? Somebody's complaining. Do I have to? And, you know, I've got a lot of inquiries this year from employers who didn't want to discipline somebody, you know, or maybe, you know, wanted to do a slap on the wrist, but there was a ton of pressure in the wake of this Charlie Kirk stuff that you got to fire this person. Right. And they didn't really want to, you know, and so, you know, the employer isn't always looking to fire somebody. Unions, you know, a lot of times they're looking to figure out how do we apply the rules fairly and avoid discipline or avoid terminating somebody. So let's turn back the clock from Charlie Kirk in 2025 to George Floyd in 2020, you know, and kind of lots of similarities. Honestly, we have a very high profile incident that happens and people feel very strongly about, you know, this horrible thing that happened. And then other people might feel very strongly about the stuff that people post on social media about the incident or about the person involved. And then what does the government do when there are complaints? And so we're going to start out the first case that I think was in the order that they were decided was August 13th. And this was Melton versus City of Forest City. I love cities with two names. It's the City of Forest City. Don't call it Forest City. You must call it the City of Forest City. And so in June of 2020, we have a firefighter involved in this. Firefighter goes on Facebook, posts this meme. You can, if you Google it, Melton versus City of Forest City, decided by the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals on August 13th of 2025. If you Google that case, you can you see a picture of the image, and we might post it in the show notes if you want to find your way to the show notes on LRS's website. Feel free to do so. But it was a black and white image of a baby in the womb with a rope around the baby's neck, accompanied by the caption, "I can't breathe." Now, this is in the wake of George Floyd being murdered, right? "I can't breathe" has significant, in particular significance in connection with that incident. The baby, by the way, it was a black and white image. The baby was black. The noose was white. All kinds of racial undertones and things involved here. Melton said, this was my opinion on abortion and the hypocrisy of complaining about this one thing when other, babies are killed, et cetera. That was the gist of what Melton or how Melton justified his post. He posts it. Somebody lets him know really quick, like, "Yo, dude, this came up on my feed. Are you nuts? Take it down." It was, I think, a retired friend of his out of the department said, you better take this down. He took it down immediately. It wasn't up very long at all. Too late. Somehow it got its way to the mayor. And there's the first lesson. If you think something is private, if you think it's only going to go to your Facebook friends or whatever, you are wrong, man. If you only intended 9 other people to see it, tough shit. You put it on social media, it is just going to roll. You cannot control where it's going to go. And courts are very clear about this. Courts do not care if you intended for it to be private. Courts say, you better know if you post it on social media, anybody can grab it. Anybody can screenshot it. Or somebody who's actively looking for an excuse to fire a police officer might be trolling for offensive police officer social media posts. you know, and they might then make a big deal about it, even though you didn't intend a million people to see it, a million people might see it. So you kind of, you know, you run the risk of things going viral when you put it out there. And so that's what happened here. You didn't expect a ton of people to see it, but somehow somebody screenshots it. It makes its way back to the chief and they fire him. They fire him immediately. The mayor, not the chief. They fire Melton immediately. He sues. And, you know, Melton won, you know, ultimately before the circuit court. The circuit court said, you know, they said, oh, this created a firestorm and we had to respond because people were just up in arms over this really offensive post. And employers, when you take those positions, you got to back it up. You can't just allege it. That's another lesson from these cases. You can't just say these types of posts are inappropriate. You're going to have to show something. You don't necessarily have to show actual disruption, but you're going to have to show a significant likelihood of disruption. You can't just wave a wand and expect the court to go your way. And in fact, that's what happened here because there was no disruption. I'm going to quote from the case. There was no showing that Melton's post had an impact on the fire department itself. No current firefighter complained or confronted him about it, nor did any coworker or supervisor refuse to work with him. Nobody even knew about it, right? You know, until somebody complained or the mayor happened to see it. You know, and so interesting, in how that case developed. The court really looked at, well, what actually happened here? Yes, this was an offensive post, but you know, did it really disrupt the government's ability to have a fire department? Really? You know, in the Eighth Circuit, the court didn't buy it. And so ultimately, Melton was successful. So we have one employee who wins. Now let's go across the country to Cambridge, right? In the First Federal Circuit in Massachusetts. In this case, it's Hussey versus City of Cambridge. This was decided 2 days later on August 15th of 2025. Now, this one is a police officer, not a firefighter. And Officer Hussey makes a Facebook post, not in May, June of 2020, but in February of 21, where Congress introduced the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, you know, which, by the way, was a terrible act. It would have done a lot of rotten things. And it was never enacted into law. That's my, you know, editorial opinion there, you know, because it really did a lot of stuff that was completely unrelated to George Floyd. And it just was, you know, just harmed police officers. This guy, Hussey, posts. So this is what it's come to. He passes along forwards coverage of the introduction of the George Floyd Act. He says, so this is what it's come to: honoring a career criminal, a thief, and a druggie. The future of this country is bleak at best, right? And so he's saying, you know, come on, you know, it's George Floyd, like now he's a hero. What the hell? You know, we're going to name a police reform bill after this. He's expressing an opinion. Again, not the best opinion. Not sure why he's expressing it on Facebook, but he decided to do that. He posts it. He promptly deletes it because somebody contacts him and says the same thing. Like, yo, what are you doing, dude? Take that down. You're going to get in trouble. He takes it down promptly. Too late. The chief gets it. Chief gets it. Somebody gets it to the NAACP, gets it to the chief. Hussey is going to, Hussey gets disciplined. Now, a big difference, you know, here factually was that Hussey wasn't fired. He just got a 4-day suspension, you know, which is also kind of like, well, what are you doing, man? You got a 4-day suspension. Maybe you live with it, but you know, I don't know. Maybe it was the principle of the thing. Hussey sues, challenging his 4-day suspension. And ultimately, he loses. And so the court in Hussey, you know, the same test, right? The same legal standard applies it to these particular facts. And the court said that, yeah, you know, he was talking about a matter of public concern, but like not all speech should be treated equally. And so speech that comments on these matters of public concern in a way that's mocking, derogatory, or disparaging should be afforded less weight in the balancing process. So if he was a firefighter talking about staffing issues in a way that wasn't mocking or derogatory, you know, his statements would be more protected. Or if he were commenting on the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, and if he expressed, you know, what he says was his real goal, and if he said, you know, I'm disappointed that, you know, we're naming this particular bill after this individual. It has nothing to do with, you know, this particular incident that happened in Minnesota. There could be a way that's not as offensive to express that opinion. In fact, there absolutely would be. If he expressed the same opinion, but did so in a more polite way, I guess you might say, what the court is saying is that would have gotten more protection. That would have been more protected than the language that he used. I'll tell you, the language he used wasn't that bad. Calling somebody a druggie or a thief, I mean, good Lord, in 2025, people call people a lot worse than that. But so a little bit of a thumb on the scale for the government because of the nature of the speech. And now another thumb on the scale for the government, according to the court, because on the government side of the balancing test, the court said, when the employer is a law enforcement agency, you know, and there's a special degree of trust and discipline required, you know, in those agencies, they're going to have a greater ability to regulate speech than maybe like the sanitation department, right? So, okay, you know, your speech is already entitled to less protection and the government's got a greater right. Two thumbs on the scale. When the court applied the balancing test, guess who won? The government, right? And so the government's rights outweighed Hussey. So that's case number two, decided 2 days later, it went exactly the opposite direction. Then just a week later, or I guess 2 weeks later, August 26th of 25, the Seventh Circuit, you know, we're in the middle of the country, rung in a case called Hedgepeth versus Britain. Now, this one involves a school employee, a teacher, who made posts in May of 2020 as the whatever you want to call the response to the Floyd murder. I mean, you want to call them riots, summer riots, you want to call it, you know, social unrest, you can call it social unrest. You want to call it peaceful protesting, call it peaceful protesting. I'll tell you, if you're reading a case in one of these cases and they refer to what happened after Floyd is rioting, the employee is going to win. And if you're reading one of these cases and they talk about what happened in the wake of Floyd as peaceful protesting, the government's going to win. You're pretty much right down the line. So, you know, there's magic in kind of reading those, looking at the language, reading those decisions closely. In Hedgepeth, what happened is this teacher was on vacation. She's an Illinois teacher, high school teacher. She's down in Florida on vacation, and she starts posting a series of Facebook posts while watching whatever was happening on TV, on CNN. So whether they were in whatever cities they were looking at with all the craziness was happening. And she starts posting stuff, including, she says, these, you know, the protesters should be hosed down with high pressure water hoses. She starts comparing the term white privilege to the N word, like not thinking straight. She was on vacation. Maybe, you know, who knows what she was doing. But some pretty silly posts for somebody to be making. The issue there was pretty interesting because her post went viral. Why? She's a high school teacher. She was Facebook friends with a lot of former students, probably some current students. And as soon as they see, oh, Mrs. Hedgepeth is posting all kinds of crazy stuff, it goes all over the place, right? So all the students get it. Their parents get it. There's lots of complaints to the school. They have a special school board meeting to talk about what was going on. There were hundreds of emails and complaints. And you know, she's like, I just made some Facebook posts on my private account. You know, what do you mean here? I didn't intend to do anything. But what happened was she was speaking as a private citizen, and yeah, she was speaking on a matter of public concern. But when we applied that balancing test, the court said, well, you're right to kind of spout off about what you thought was happening on the streets of American cities. You know, was outweighed by the school district's right to, or obligation to run an efficient business. And the statements that you made caused significant disruption in the court's view to school operations. They had to hold a special school board meeting. They had to deal with plenty of complaints. There were lots of issues there. And so the bigger, like the hubbub caused by what you posted, the government's going to have a greater ability to discipline you regardless of what you said or why you said it. And so that's the takeaway, you know, and so Hedgepeth loses that case. So the three cases decided in the fall, two went for the employer and one went for the employee. And when you look at that in terms of, what we saw in the wake of Charlie Kirk, if you're looking to get somebody fired, you just create a big hubbub, man, you know, like get it, you know, just everybody, you know, get on social media, have everybody contact this mayor and demand that this person be fired. And, you know, they used to call that the heckler's veto, and it's not supposed to matter. You're not supposed to, in speech cases, let the masses dictate what should happen. But it seems to me, in the way the courts apply the third prong of the Pickering test with respect to social media cases, that's exactly what happens. There is a heckler's veto. And when we have these organized attempts, and we didn't just see it from the right in the wake of Charlie Kirk, we saw it for years, both before and after George Floyd, lots of websites out there that would aggregate police officer Facebook posts. There's something called the Plainview Project, by groups that were doing the same thing. They were advocating that police officers be fired. They were less aggressive about it, and I think that's just because our culture has gotten more savvy and more aggressive. But you know, that could be the next thing, is some really super savvy organized campaign to fire teachers or firefighters or police officers coming from the left and not the right. You just never know. But I think that as it relates to how courts are going to deal with these things, it's something we really have to be aware of. And I think that that's why the pendulum, which I thought was going in the direction of employees, is now going back in the direction of employers. Just another reason that people should just stay off social media, if you can, especially when it comes to, you know, posting things that might be in any way considered controversial. So that's takeaway number one from 25. The second trend that I think was the most significant trend that we saw in public safety labor relations in 2025, was what I would call the downside of recruiting and retention. I can't even identify like a recruiting and retention crisis in public safety as a trend. I mean, we're in the midst of a staffing crisis. We've been in the middle of a staffing crisis for years now, especially in law enforcement, but even in fire. So that's not trendy. That just is what it is. And employers and unions are trying to figure out, you know, what can we do to get people into the industries and to keep them in the industries. I think unions have had a lot of really good ideas. We talk about those at seminars. We're seeing some of those things. The introduction of sabbaticals is something new that we're seeing, much more attention to work-life balance is something that we're seeing, addressing privacy protections, in contracts, those are things that aren't monetary, but mean a lot, to public safety employees. So there are things you can do to address those. The trend that, kind of saw in connection with that is really what I would call the downside of recruiting and retention. And we did talk about a couple cases related to this year, so I wanted to note it. But there's really two, things related to the downside of the recruiting and retention crisis. And the reason I say the downside is the upside is great contracts. You're seeing really good raises. You're seeing really good collective bargaining agreements for police, fire, and corrections pretty much everywhere across the country. Lots of reasons for that. But, it's supply and demand. When you can't keep people, you make pay and benefits better. And so the tendency is to think from the union side that it's all positive. This is great, unless you're working 3,000 hours a year because there aren't enough people. But there is a downside. And, the two biggest ones that we've seen, and I think it's getting worse, the first one is lowering standards. Sometimes you'll hear employers talk about, expanding the net. Taking a broader view of candidates that we're bringing into the industry. And that means considering people that we wouldn't, maybe have otherwise considered had we had enough applicants. I don't think there's any other way to describe that than lowering standards. That's what you're doing. And that's what lots of public safety agencies have been doing over the last few years. What does that mean? Entry age, has been reduced. It used to be routinely you had to be 21, certainly to be a law enforcement officer or a firefighter. We're seeing agencies reduce those down, to 18. Think about how mature your 18-year-old is and then say, hey, let's give him a gun and have him go out and patrol, cities. I'm not sure that that's what we want to do, but agencies are being forced to do that. Education levels, plenty of agencies, there's lots of, police departments across the country where not too terribly long ago, I mean, you needed a bachelor's degree to get a job, in some of these departments. And if not that, you definitely needed an associate's degree. Well, we've seen those things go out the window because we just needed more candidates. And so agencies have been lowering degree requirements pretty much across the board. We saw that accelerate in 2025, the FBI, I think, is probably the biggest example. There were a lot of really troubling things that happened at the federal level in 2025. Some good things, but a lot of bad ones. It was very surprising to see the FBI lower its recruiting standards. And what they did was they eliminated the recruiting, eliminated the college degree requirement. They reduced the academy from 18 weeks to 8 weeks, things like that, basically because we can't find enough people and people are washing out of the academy. You've seen agencies lower physical fitness requirements, which again, is problematic, from the folks who listen to this podcast who are in the industry. Certainly it's not just policing, fire, corrections. These jobs do not get less complicated. Every year that goes by, they get more and more complex. And if anything, we probably should be raising standards and not lowering them. I'll do one flip side, some things that have worked. We've seen agencies, especially with physical fitness standards, look at lowering maybe the entry requirement into an academy, but keeping on the back end the requirement the same. And so maybe we're going to accept more people in, but we're going to work harder to get them up to an appropriate level. So you're not really lowering the standards to enter the job, but you may be lowering the standards to enter the academy. We've seen that work in larger agencies. The Army's got a great, the U.S. Army's got a great program, the Future Soldier Prep Course, they call it. It's basically 90 days to kind of get up to snuff to meet minimum academic and physical fitness standards in order to get you into basic training. So these are people who would otherwise wash out. The Army reports that like 25% of their basic training recruits in 2025 graduated from this thing. So this is like, 25% of your new people coming in wouldn't have actually been eligible, right? And so, and they say there's good results there. We shall see. So maybe there are some positive ways to meet that, but I'm generally concerned with this issue of lowering standards. We will see. It's going to take a couple of years for that to bubble up, And if we have unqualified people making mistakes on the job, that could hurt everybody. And we've seen that. Go back to, if you really are interested in this stuff, go back to Washington, D.C. and the District of Columbia's experiences in the 90s after Congress, in a fit of whatever Congress gets into a fit to, I think they threatened to withhold, it was like $3 billion in funding from the district unless they hired 1,200 police officers in a year. That's a crazy amount of officers to hire. But they were going to lose a lot of money. So what did the district do? They hired a bunch of police, hired 1,200 police officers. And then what happened in the wake of that, in the 5-6 years after that, everything fell apart. You had, lots of problems within the police department. Who knew? Who could have predicted that? So I worry, are we going to see another round of that high profile discipline cases? And is that going to be a problem for everybody? So we shall see. We'll keep an eye on that. What's the other area that we've seen this in cases that the downside of the recruiting and retention crisis. And this is that, we've seen a couple of labor board decisions, more than a few actually, labor board decisions come down this year. And at LRAS, we track these from all over the country. So every labor board decision, no matter where you are having to do with public safety in any part of the country, we read them all. We look for the important ones. We share them with you in the Public Safety Labor News newsletter. If you don't subscribe to that, go to lrs.com and subscribe to that thing. It's fantastic. And you get access to our database, like 30 years of these summaries. So we read them all and we see them, and that's how we can identify trends. And so interesting series of cases that we saw this year dealing with things that, if they were decided, same issue, same facts, but like, maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, they probably would have gone the union's way. But instead they went the employer's way. And I think that only, can be traced back to understaffing. And so can the understaffing erode, basically the union's ability to require bargaining over certain things? And so let me give you an example of a case that is what I would say maybe the good way or the old way. And this was a decision that we talked about. This is actually last year or in 2024. It came out of King County in the state of Washington. And this was you set in a county jail in King County. And it had to do with a change in the criteria that would be enable the county to force people to work mandatory overtime, right? Or the question of whether or not your physical ability to work mandatory overtime is an essential function of your job. And what happened in this particular jail is that officers would get notes, doctor's notes, to where their doctor would say that, you're not physically able to work more than 40 hours in a week or 50 hours in a week or whatever it is. And so basically, if you give the employer a note, you would be eligible for FMLA leave that you would then use instead of working an overtime shift. And, you know, we see this, you know, this comes up from time to time. And so if I've got one of these notes that says I can only work 40 hours in a week, then I don't have to work mandatory overtime. And who has to work it? Well, all my colleagues have to work it. So if one person has a note, that's really not that big a deal, I guess. If two have a note, it's not that big a deal. But the more people have a note, the more burden on everybody else, and it can become a problem. Now, the King County case was very interesting because this jail employed, it was 380 officers, right? And this was all on the record. Going back to 2009, right? So they went pretty far back. And they would call these officers who had the overtime notes restricted officers. And so from like 2009 through 2017, the number of restricted officers, there was always like 10 to 15, right, of 380 or so, you know, 400 officers that were restricted. Okay, doable, not that big a deal. What happens in 19 and into 2020? Gee, anything happening in 2020, you know, some kind of disease that might be highly contagious where you might not want to be working in a confined space? I don't know. Was anything like that happening in 2020? I mean, jails were always unsafe places to work, but during COVID, holy shit, right? And it was a tough place to be. And all of a sudden we went from 10 to 15 restricted officers up to 90, right? So almost 25% of the workforce now had these notes that said, you can't make me work overtime. It only got worse. By the court says, by the time we got to the beginning of 22, we had 150 of 380 officers who had overtime notes. By the end of 22, it had increased to 250, right? So well more than half, right, of 380 officers who had overtime notes. So really it was an untenable situation. And what happened was in the summer of 2023, the county then implemented a policy change. And they basically said, look, you know, if you can't work these overtime shifts, you know, we're gonna grant them to you under the FMLA. And that's a whole other episode. But basically you could run up to basically 480 hours, you know, worth of missed shifts. And in a jail where there's lots of overtime, you can hit that number really quick. What the county did before is they never fired people. So you just basically had unlimited missed overtime shifts and there was no consequence. What the county unilaterally did in 2023 was they said, nope, we're changing the rules. Once you tap out, you know, on your FMLA number of restricted shifts, we're going to terminate you. And why are we going to terminate you? Because you're not able to perform an essential function of the job. And overtime is an essential function of this particular job. That is about as run-of-the-mill of a unilateral change in a working condition as you're ever going to see, right? And that ordinarily is going to be a slam dunk charge. The union files an unfair practice charge. And what happened? They won. Right. And, you know, and the labor board said, you know, we're sympathetic to the employer staffing dilemma. And this is a quote, while I am sympathetic to the employer staffing dilemma, that dilemma did not relieve it of the obligation to provide the officers notice and an opportunity to bargain before they unilaterally change this thing. That's the way these cases are supposed to be decided. Union successful. They sit down, they work something out, they resolve their problem. That's the way they're normally decided. All right. So what's the problem? By the time we get to 2025, here's a case out of Rhode Island, State versus Rhode Island State Labor Relations Board, decided in April of 2025. And this particular case is a very similar situation. It's another correctional facility. The DOC in that instance changed the attendance policy. They changed the sick policy, and they basically made it, they accelerated the disciplinary tracks for sick, you know, abuse. Right. So absenteeism, it was a faster track to get fired. They tightened up sick note rules. And specifically those restricted notes that, you know, say you can't work overtime. They, you know, tightened up the rules on that. And they said, we're going to follow the FMLA to the letter. Here are the steps you have to jump through, which they never did before. And they also identified different areas where they could discipline people for like patterns, you know, the day before or after vacation, stuff like that. So they unilaterally tightened up a lot of their sick leave abuse rules. You know, in a bargaining state, that's easy, right? That's something you got to bargain over. And if you unilaterally change, you know, those sick leave rules, that's going to be a violation of state law. That's the position the union took. They said, you never bargained with us over these things. We disagree. And they filed a charge and they won, you know, before the state labor board. The employer appealed it, and the case made its way up to the Supreme Court. and the employer won in the Supreme Court. And this is where it gets interesting, and this is where I think we look at the downside of recruiting and retention, because the court said that, you know, they we're going to connect the dots here between absenteeism, okay, which is, you know, an important issue, and safety, right? And it was the, you know, the absenteeism abuse, right, makes understaffing issues worse, and that's true. We know that there, so absenteeism is connected to understaffing. Understaffing, right, is connected to, in a negative way, it negatively impacts the inmate client. Why? Because we're closing posts, we're limiting medical visits, we're limiting education opportunities, we're going to have lockdown more frequently, right? So all of those changes that are staffing related, staffing driven, are going to make the inmate climate worse. We're going to have people who ain't very happy. And then a negative inmate climate has a very real and, you know, bad effect on the safety of the institution as a whole, right? Not just inmates, you know, but officers. So absenteeism to understaffing, understaffing to negative climate to unsafe. And so the employer argued that it's our, we have an inherent right and obligation to maintain a safe institution. And because we, you know, because of that, and because of the problems we were facing, we needed to take these steps of unilaterally changing the sick leave rules. The Supreme Court went the employer's way. Great job, employer, in connecting those dots. And that's what I would say from a practitioner's approach. You know, you're going to really need to make that connection. And it sounds like they did a good job there. But that's a very interesting case in that, you know, I don't think we would have seen that case go the employer's way just a few years ago. So we really are seeing the staffing crisis kind of, you know, make its way into some of these decisions. And then we had another one that we talked about in 25 out of Hudson County, New Jersey. And this was another corrections case. And in this particular case, there was a high profile assault, an inmate assault that seriously injured a correctional officer. In response to that, well, the county changed schedules to boost their weekend coverage. And so what they did was they basically moved schedules around so nobody had a weekend off. Right. So people used to have a day or 2 days or whatever. They got moved. The county, you know, the county said, what are you talking about? You're still working the same amount of hours in a week, but now your off days are Monday, Tuesday instead of Saturday, Sunday. You know, people are going to have a problem with that, especially the senior people who worked years to get to that, you know, that good schedule. The county makes the change, and to make it worse, they did it in the middle of negotiations, right? They're in the middle of contract negotiations. The county was actually proposing to do this in negotiations and to do some other things to boost weekend coverage. The union, you know, didn't agree to it, at least yet, you know, at that point in negotiations. The county went ahead and implemented it anyway. The union filed a charge. This is, again, this should be easy. A unilateral change to working condition, especially one they had already proposed to do. The charge was dismissed by Jersey's labor board, Jersey's PERC. You know, and basically, you know, the PERC, there was a contract provision in dispute there, but the court looked at the employer's inherent managerial right, and they had a managerial prerogative to maintain a safe institution. And same thing, they connected staffing shortages to a high profile safety incident in which an officer was harmed and said, we had to do what we had to do to protect the safety of the institution. So when they make it about safety, as opposed to, we just don't want to blow up our overtime budget, which a lot of times that's kind of what it is, they're going to be in a better position, especially this year. Last case, similar case out of San Bernardino County in California. Similar change. This is for youth detention officers. And the change here was rotating people from basically better assignments into more dangerous, kind of crappy assignments in the juvenile jail. Those are the most dangerous ones too, right? Everybody knows that. So you had people who were working in the courthouse or at other assignments that now had to go into the jail, and they didn't want to do it. That was a unilateral change to how these deployments were made. The union filed an unfair practice. That was dismissed. And you can kind of read into the lines there. The court, the labor board decided that case on a timeliness issue. But if you really read it closely, it was pretty clear that the court was very concerned about understaffing and the reason why they made this change. Same thing in San Bernardino as in Hudson County. There was a really high profile violent incident in which an officer was harmed, was hurt, seriously injured, and that was solely because of a staffing shortage. And so, you know, I think that, you know, if employers can connect staffing shortages to safety, it does give them free rein to maybe do some things that they couldn't maybe do even 5 years ago. And so something to be aware of. And that's why, you know, and the staffing situation isn't getting any better. And now that you've got some of these cases coming down, you know, even though they're in different parts of the country, you're going to look to those things as precedent. And so if you see employers getting more aggressive in those areas, unions, understand that, you know, you still have the ability to push back and you should. But the rules might be a little bit different, you know, when that case gets to a hearing officer. So you just be careful when you're dealing with those proposals. Okay, the third issue. This one is not a case. It's not a case yet. Maybe it's never going to be a case. I don't know. But the third issue that garnered the most attention with us at seminars and on TikTok. We had a TikTok on this issue, had like 26,000 views, like really quick. It's crazy. And it's no tax on overtime. That big, beautiful bill and what ultimately became the Big Beautiful Bill Act was this massive tax reform legislation that was passed by Congress in the summer, had a lot of provisions in it. Some of those provisions were put in there to intend to keep promises made by President Trump during his 2024 campaign for election. No tax on Social Security, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. These were promises that the president made. And so the question was, in this tax reform bill, is he really going to keep those promises? And the answer is like, maybe. and that's how politicians keep promises. Maybe a little bit. Just enough to be able to say, see, I did what I said I was going to do. But it's not really what they said they were going to do. And, you know, that's why it's an interesting issue. And we've had lots of questions about it. Again, at seminars and on social media, and we get all kinds of inquiries. So let's just kind of recap, you know, what the promise was and what the law actually does. And so the promise was simple. You were not going to do taxes on overtime. You know, you're going to get taxed on your 40-hour work week or your 50 or 53-hour work week or whatever the hell it is. But if you work overtime, we're not going to take taxes out of that. The federal government doesn't need your money. It's going to be more money in the pockets of hardworking American workers. All right. You know, the people that voted for Trump said, this sounds good to me, right? You're my guy. And he won. We all know that. And well, was anything passed? Yes. There is a no tax on overtime provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The provision provides a deduction. So it's not no tax on overtime. There's a tax deduction for part of the overtime that you work for a certain period of time. And it's for tax years 25, 26, 27, and 28. So it's temporary, right? It's not a permanent change. Lots of things in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act are temporary. You know what? Every tax cut bill has provisions that are temporary, and then they just push it off on the next administration. You know, and if they don't let them continue, then they've increased taxes. It's just the way tax bills work. Democrats do it. Republicans do it. Republicans do it a little better, you know, and more frequently, and Democrats wind up having to fix it and get blamed for it. That's just the way it goes. Do politics better. If we get into the specifics of how that works, you're going to be able to, and this is any employee, not just a public safety employee, deduct the premium portion of your overtime pay from your taxable income. Aha, the premium portion. And if you're interested in this, the IRS was supposed to publish detailed regulations on exactly how this was going to be implemented. They gave us like a page in November. It was 6 months after the bill was passed. And it wasn't particularly helpful, but if you Google IRS regs, no tax on overtime, you can find your way there and you can read it. It basically explains a little bit of what the premium portion is. And the premium portion is only it's the half in time and a half. So it's only the extra pay above your regular hourly rate. You know, and so if I work an overtime shift, I'm not paying taxes on that? No, that's not what that is. You're going to pay taxes on that overtime shift on the straight time portion, right? It's the half, the premium part, you don't pay tax on, right? So that's where you start getting into the fine print. And the question is, well, what if I, you know, I'm in California or I'm other states where certain overtime is mandatory at the double time rate? Or what if in your contract, like mandatory overtime is double time? Or sometimes if you go over X number of shifts or X number of overtime hours in a pay period, it increases to double time as a disincentive, right, to overtime. Is the second half, if it's double time, is that all the premium portion? Can we deduct that? The IRS answered that with certainty in November, and they said, no, it's only half. So if you work double time, time and a half of that is taxed, right? The extra half, the original half, is deductible. That's how it works. Is all of it deductible? No. So you can deduct up to $12,500 in a year if you're single, or $25,000 if you're married. If you know, I am married. If I work, you know, $30,000 in qualified overtime under this law, my wife doesn't work any, I can deduct $25,000, right? So it's not like 12.5, 12.5. So the total is higher. So it's either 12.5 or $25,000 in a deduction. So you can reduce your taxable income, you know, by $25,000. And if you're at, you know, 22, 24% tax rate, that's pretty significant chunk of change. You know, it's, you know, several thousand dollars in your pocket. So it is going to feel good, right? That is a tax cut. It's just, there's a lot of fine print there. Another issue is that only certain categories of overtime are going to be protected. So it's overtime that would otherwise be required under the Fair Labor Standards Act, not all overtime. So that means that like post-shift overtime might not count. It means that if you work overtime in a week where under your contract, let's say you have a contract that, let's make it the best version of this. So the best version of overtime provision in a union contract is going to be simple. It's all hours worked outside of the officer's regularly scheduled shift or paid at overtime. Okay. So if you're held over for 2 hours, those extra 2 hours are overtime. If you're called in on an off day, that's all overtime, right? We just keep it simple. If you took 3 vacation shifts that week and then you're called in for overtime, it's overtime. It's outside of your regular scheduled shift. Well, those aren't the rules for Joe Schmo in the private sector. There's a law called the Fair Labor Standards Act, and it provides basic protections, right? It's like literally the minimum wage. there's levels below which an employer cannot go. And one of those, it relates to overtime. And so if you're in a place where your paid leave counts as hours worked towards your overtime threshold, and you get overtime because of that, that may not count. That may not be qualified overtime, because for Joe Schmo who works at Walmart, the 40-hour work week is 40 hours actually worked. So let's assume you worked an 8-hour shift. If you were, and you're a Monday through Friday employee, you work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You physically work 32 hours. You take a vacation day Friday. And then you work an overtime shift on Saturday, another 8-hour shift. You've worked 48 hours in that week. So you might think that Saturday shift is going to be overtime. It's not. It's not under the Fair Labor Standards Act, because you've only physically worked 40 hours, right? You got paid for 48 because you used a vacation day, but that doesn't count toward the threshold. In most union contracts, that kind of leave is going to count toward the threshold, right? So you're going to be left in a situation where you're like, oh gosh, you know, I can just, this is going to be simple. I deduct, you know, the half and time and a half. If I made $15,000 in overtime on my, you know, I see it in my last paycheck for 2025, I know that $5,000 I can deduct. Nope, not that simple. I wish it was, but it's not. And so you're really going to have to work through this stuff. A couple other things to deal with that. We thought that the W-2, there was going to be a requirement that employers calculate this number and report qualified overtime on W-2 forms issued for 2025, because the deduction applies for the entirety of 2025, even though the law was passed in the summer. It's for the full tax year. Employers don't have to do that. We think it's going to be optional, but employers aren't required to do that. Employees can just kind of make it up. If you track your overtime, you just talk to your accountant and figure out, you know, whether you're eligible or not. The other thing that they said is you can prorate overtime for the year. So for the second half of the year. So if I worked $20,000 worth of overtime from July to December of 2025, I can then kind of prorate that to mean I worked $40,000 for the year. You're allowed to do that in 2025 because it kind of basically saying, well, employers might not have been paying attention to this until July was the idea. If you worked all your overtime the first 6 months of the year, does that mean you get to go back and count that? Nope, sorry, it doesn't really work that way. So that's a bit of a drag. You know, so that's interesting. There are caps. The deduction starts to phase out at $150,000 in earnings for single and for $300,000 for married filers. And that's going to gradually reduce. And so you want to be aware of that. And withholding continues, right? So payroll, withholding, taxes, all that comes out. So if you're working overtime, you know, your paycheck, you know, those federal income taxes are going to be withheld just like they always have been. The only difference is at the end of the year, you might be able to go back and get a deduction. So, you know, lots of details there, tons of questions about this at seminars. And again, you know, over the, as the course of the year has gone on, we've gotten lots of them. Our recommendation is we got a bit of a pass for 2025, a little bit easier for, you know, employers and employees. Well, easier for employers. I don't know about employees. But I really recommend that, you know, at the local level, unions sit down with your, you know, employer and say, what, you know, what is your plan for 2026 for overtime? Are we going to categorize? Are they going to specifically, and I would recommend that they specifically track qualified overtime so that you can get this deduction and we don't have to go back and do crazy math to figure out how many of my shifts were double time, you know, or how many of my overtime shifts were in weeks when I used paid leave, right? There should be ways to try to track that prospectively so that we have people that are reporting things accurately to the IRS, which, you know, we like to do, and they don't wind up getting in trouble a few years down the road. So pretty interesting one, pretty complex one. I think we'll be talking about that for a little bit longer in 2026, but that's where it is. So those were the three developments. You know, there's privacy developments, particularly in the area of speech, the kind of the bad side of the recruiting and retention crisis as it relates to you know, really bargaining rights and bargaining obligations, and also lowering standards potentially in public safety agencies. And then finally, all the attention around no tax on overtime. Those were the three biggies. That's what we spent, you know, most of our time talking about and hearing from people about in 2025. Let us know if that matches up with your experiences. You know, you can always, you know, hey, subscribe to the podcast. You know, you can email us at info@lris.com if you thought there was some other issue that was bigger or more important than this. And, you know, I think that's it for this part of our 2025 year end 2026 beginning podcast. Join us, you know, in a little bit for part two, where we're going to talk about three predictions for 2026. And that episode ain't going to be as long. We're not going to get too detailed, but there are some things that we want to predict. And then this time next year, we'll check in and see how close we are. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. And if you don't catch us for part two, I hope you have a happy, healthy, wonderful 2026.